The Voice That Thunders by Alan Garner. This is the final essay in the book of essays, also entitled The Voice That Thunders. The end of a book tends to write itself. What I have to do is to sit, breathe, and make the marks on the paper. Then, with exponential speed, it is last page, last paragraph, last sentence, last line, last letter, full stop. I placed the full stop of Strandloper, looked at my watch and wrote 14:30, Tuesday, 25th of April, 1995. Then I went back to the full stop and thought, why didn't I put just that in the first place? What I had undergone had all been to reach a full stop. The point was the point. I had set off for it by deciding to do something useful on a hot day. I had brought up from the files a box I use for newspaper cuttings that I keep in case any of them should provoke an idea in the future, and started to cull the redundant. I chid myself for having amassed so much dross for my magpie mind. Then I stopped and read and reread an item from the Congleton Chronicle, a local newspaper, of November 1977. I must have read the article before, otherwise it would not have been in the box. Yet I had no memory of it, while now it burned in my brain. It was a brief article recording the story of a 20-year-old bricklayer, William Buckley, from my neighbouring hamlet of Martin, who had been transported for life to New Holland in 1803, had escaped into the bush, survived, and had lived for 32 years as an Aborigine before joining a party of prospecting Englishmen in order to prevent their massacre, as a result of which he was given a free pardon. The article was headed The Wild Man of Martin. I looked at my watch and noted 14:30, Tuesday, 21st of June, 1983, William Buckley. So it began. Why had something presented as amusing and trivial taken up precisely 4,326 days of my life and produced a novel at an average rate of 14.1 words a day, or approximately 0.5875 words an hour? There are two answers. The first is that it had been the most rewarding and demanding period of my life so far. The second is that I had no choice. I did not even have to defend myself by hiding behind Hazlitt's statement that if a man leaves behind him any work which is a model of its kind, we have no right to ask whether he could do anything else, or how he did it, or how long he was about it. I'm going to try and communicate something of this experience, despite Hazlitt. The first question has to be asked may be phrased as, why subject oneself to the ordeal of constructing a work of fiction? The answer is the world is messy and the truth hard to find in its tangled thickets. Truth is best found by the writers taking the facts, pruning them, and then arranging what is left into the simplest possible pattern. This necessitates a degree of fabrication, which presents us with a paradox that the writer has to manipulate the facts in order to make what is essential clear and true. At its most extreme, reality can be expressed in art most accurately as myth. And as I progressed into Strandloper, I became aware that the historical William Buckley's life matched the elements of the mythic quest. There's no altruism in what I was doing. Writers at the point of writing, in the preparation for writing, in the act of writing, are the most selfish of beings. They have no social concern. Only their obsession matters, and you interrupt a writer then at your peril. So a better question is, what makes some people, regardless of cost to themselves and others, write at all? Subjectively, it is merely something that has to be done. Plato set poets, of which he was one, at the top of his hit list against the day when he could establish his ideal state. And the world authority in her field, the American psychiatrist K. Redfield Jameson, has made the grotesque discovery in her surveys of writers and of creativity in the arts, the military professions and those of business, that some 50% of the significant innovators suffer from a lethal psychosis. Lethal because of its 50% suicide risk, which is largely ignored by society, since occurrence in the general public is not more than 1%. The last impression I want to make is one of angst or gloom. The brain is too clever for that. The main drive is what C.S. Lewis cunningly calls joy. And it is finding that joy that the brain is at its most clever. I am happiest when engaged in establishing and pursuing research. In order to make sense, it is time for me to say a little of how I write. Not how to write, just how I write. I'll use Strandloper, since it's the nearest to my experience. I count as my main asset the combination of an academic's and the magpie's mind that sees, finds, or makes connections and patterns where others do not. Also essential to creativity is the ability to doodle mentally and to play. I read a newspaper cutting about a curious fellow from Martin. I know instantly that I am pregnant with his story. I look at the story and make a list of the primary subjects that I shall have to know about in great detail before I can begin. And they will each consist of separate fibres, as in a rope, which will unwind and have to be followed in their turn as I progress. The fibres will have fibres. Here is the academic at work. I must learn all there is to be known. I grow a bibliography. I read and read and take notes, books of notes. And this is the joy that leads me on. I am learning what I did not know. And unlike purely academic work, the subjects appear not to be linked. For instance, medieval English stained glass, the system of convict transport in the 19th century, neurological disturbance of the optic nerve and its cultural significance, and that is only a fraction. The magpie is gratified by the collecting, and the writer is enthralled as the unconnected themes begin to converge, apparently of their own accord, although I'm aware of the more mundane theory of selective perception. And for me it is the convergence, an elegant and natural simplicity of resolution, that hidden union which has always been waiting, the numinous as a book. The point cannot be reached by the academic element, which is a drudge. There comes a moment when all has been read. The intellect then is to be suppressed because I can't think something into being. That is the job of the subconscious. It shows and tells so that I see and dream and hear and find. I am the sophisticated word processor and the first reader. Thereafter, the intellect is free to edit what the subconscious has written. Before I say more of William Buckley, I should put the culling of the files into perspective. It was the summer solstice of 1983. The last piece of original work that I had written, the Stone Book Quartet, was finished in the summer of 1977. 6 years had gone by in silence. There had been nothing to add. When may we expect the next novel, said my publisher of the day. When it's ready, I said, and got on with not writing. Fortunately for my nervous system, I have never given much credence to the phenomenon of writer's block. I was much more inclined to think of it as a writer's impatience, and to follow Arthur Koestler's dictum, soak and wait. With the Stone Book Quartet, I had emptied my well, and nothing could be done until the water table was restored. And that is where I was at the summer solstice of 1983 until 2:30 p.m., when the well became a gusher. My first problem was to find William Buckley. He was said to be born in 1780 and brought up by his grandfather. I searched the decayed parish registers. There was no trace, no record of him. Then a voice, which many writers learned to heed, said, "Bishop's transcripts." At the period in question, and for centuries before that, the priest of a parish was obliged not only to keep his registers, but each year to make a copy and to send it to the bishop's palace. By the end of the 18th century, the provision of a bishop's transcript had become patchy. One nearby incumbent of Martin kept the actual registers themselves in a bag by his chair, the easier to light his pipe with the spills he made from them. So as I sat in the county records office in Chester, contemplating the pile of uncatalogued sheets the archivist had brought from the vaults, I was not optimistic. The baptisms of the transcript were there for 1782. They are identical to those of the register, with one additional entry. William, son of Eliza Buckley, March the 31st. And in the margin, in another hand, illegitim. The county record reeled as I involuntarily yelled, "Oh, William." The next part was easy. Now the clue was in my hand. Eliza was the teenage daughter of Jonathan Buckley, and she had an older brother, William, after whom to name a son. The following day, I was in the John Rylands Library of Manchester University, which holds the archive of the Martin estate. Within minutes, I had identified Jonathan Buckley's farm, such as it was. 1 acre, 3 roods, and 30 perches of bits of scattered land. From the rent books and maps and the subsequent change of the house into a school. I had to see inside the house, to feel where William had grown up, to stand in the room from which he had gone out to spend 32 years as an Aborigine. I stooped under the beams. William had been measured at 6 feet, 5 7/8 inches tall in 1835. The headroom in the transport ship in which he had spent 6 months chained in darkness with no sight of the sun had been 5 feet, 7 inches below the beams. By the end of it, I felt that I knew the inside of William Buckley very well, simply by inference from what I found he had experienced. But still, I had to look into Buckley's eyes. I had identified his closest living relative, Arthur Buckley. I was warned that he was old, ill, reclusive, depressed, and bad-tempered. I went to the house at Fiddler's Elbow, where he had been born and lived all his life. I knocked on the door. Silence. I was about to knock again when I heard a slow and distant shuffling. The shuffling came closer. I felt my adrenaline pumping. Any moment now, I was going to be as near as it was possible to be to William Buckley. I was going to see into the gene pool. There was a drawing of bolts. Door opened an inch, and made out a blue eye behind thick lenses, and a spike of uncombed silver hair. That was all. Then I did a stupid thing. I entered on a preamble. Mr. Buckley. Grunt. I'm sorry to bother you, but I wonder if you could spare me a few minutes. I'd like to talk to you. I don't think so, said a toneless voice, and the door began to close. Desperate, I said, my name is Alan Garner. I had been going to say, I'm a writer. I'm working on a book about your family. Or something like that. The door was pulled wide and Arthur Buckley said, you're Collins, lad. Come in, come in. I know more about Garners than you do. And I had come in order to know more about Buckley's than he did. He beckoned me into the kitchen with his head. He walked with difficulty and never let go of his dark trousers. Sit thee down. Take thee backer. He welcomed me formally and eased himself into the only armchair. I fetched a stool from the table. He was agitated with pleasure. And I looked into an alert William Buckley. as he told me how in the 20s and 30s he had with his family and mine made up the local brass band. It had been the centre of his life. And along the length of the mantelpiece were curled and time-coloured photographs of the band in uniform with their instruments, fat Big Bill Garner in the middle holding his baton. Arthur Buckley talked obsessively, reliving the great days. But I noticed that even sitting, he kept one hand on his trousers. I asked him what was wrong. "Me braces snapped last week. Haven't you another pair?" "No, there's a strap for cases somewhere in the back bedroom, but I can't get up the stairs." I found the strap. Arthur Buckley staggered against the mantelpiece, so I stood behind him, trying to hold him upright as I tied the strap twice round. It went through my head. If only would-be doctors of philosophy who write to me asking for my opinions on my work and its relationship to structuralism, deconstructuralism, phenomenology, semiotics, reductionism, with special reference to subplot, afterplot, subvocalization, not forgetting metacognition. If they could see that writing lies more in trying to keep up an old man's trousers up, and that from such moments is born a strandloper. Arthur Buckley was tired. It was time to go. I said that I enjoyed our talk very much. "Aye," said Arthur Buckley, "we've had us a grand crack." I had to be away for a few days. I asked him whether I could come and talk again the following week. "If I'm here," he said, "then I'll tell you the truth about Maurice Garner." Finally, I asked him whether he would let me take some photographs of him. He agreed, and I took a series of close-up portraits. That's another pattern of my research. In framing the photograph, I ask basic questions of the subject. And then when I look into somebody's eyes through a lens, I see something more than with my eye alone. We parted in good cheer. When I went back a few days later, Arthur Buckley was dead. I still do not know the truth about Maurice Garner, but I had gained much of the truth about William Buckley. I knew him now. The rest of the English section of the book and the transportation to Australia presented no irresolvable problems. I had to follow the lines of the pattern. Then came alarm. The lines were there and flowing, yet they were starting to approach and to interact with other lines, a pattern I had dealt with in the Stonebrook Quartet. The cross-references were unavoidable. The Stonebrook Quartet had been written as a sequel to Strandloper, beginning 9 years before Strandloper was conceived. That inner voice which instructs but will not discuss told me not to hesitate. So I put my disconcentration aside and obeyed. I continued to pursue the Lewisian joy. What can be said to have been among the qualities of Strandloper, to compensate for the difficulties, is that it has been a joyous work in its making. Everybody I have approached has been friendly and eager to help. But beware, I warned against involvement with writers. The ruthlessness can take many forms, and I should tell you that whenever you're in the presence of a writer, anything you say will be taken down, and it will be used. The difference of Strandloper is the victims are not merely acquiesced, they have shared in the joy. What happens is that the writer, having written a paragraph or about to start one, feels something extra is needed, something slight, a seasoning more than an ingredient. These seasons cannot be invented, they have to be stolen. They make all the difference, changing a text from adequate to inspired. A new butcher has moved to our nearby village, which has an enclave of insecure, upwardly mobile executives. They expect civility, not only civility, from shopkeepers. To help him at weekends, the butcher employs Raymond, a retired colleague who was the apprentice of my father's best friend. I had not seen Raymond for nearly 50 years. But the first time I went into the shop, we spontaneously broke into a loud exchange of improvised sexual verbal abuse and scatology, lowering the executive tone, all in broad dialect. I saw the young butcher's eyes flicker in alarm. Barred for business. Give over, says Raymond. I've known how Alan says his bum were as big as me shirt button. Within half an hour, it was in the book, making a crucial scene, not just sorrowful, but seethingly human. Nicknames cannot be improvised either. All the nicknames of Strandloper are local men, delivered mostly by the stonemason Ken. His one misgiving is that Eggy Moe, an innocent in the book, and near a psychopath in reality, may not be the illiterate he is said to be. Taxi driver John used to be a coalman after his father, and so, inevitably in Cheshire, is known as Cobby. I asked him if he would mind if I borrowed him. He was so amused that he told me a rhyme long known in his family. Old Cobb and young Cobb's son. Young Cobb's old Cobb when old Cobb's done. He was giving me more than he knew. In Cheshire dialect, Cobby is a coalman, but Cobby is chief man, governor of a gang, leader. This was so important that the rhyme not only went into the dialogue, but shifted the structure of the book and gave the name to one of its sections. It expressed the inexpressible. In particular, at one cathartic resolution of an aboriginal acceptance of the pain of what had to be to achieve the purpose of a life. Or from asking an ex-coalman if I could use his name, which I did, as well as the rhyme. A last example. I needed an opening for the first chapter of The Transport to Australia, something memorable, poetic, yet indicative of a destroyed mind. The text reads, I chases them, I flaps my apron at them, but they sees me coming. They sees my apron, and I'll get them one day. I chases them, I flaps my apron at them, but they sees me coming. They sees my apron, but I'll get them one day. It is all the character ever says, but he says it for 6 months. The fragmentation and the rhythm enabled me to create whole scenes in the smallest space by using single phrases or sentences impressionistically to show the duration of the voyage. Even to it being used for the committal of the man's corpse to the sea. In our son's first term at New College, Oxford, he was sitting by the lake with three friends watching the ducks when out of the bushes ran a scout, a college servant, making for the ducks, shouting, I chases them, I flaps my apron at them, but they sees me coming. They sees my apron, but I'll get them one day. Nobody is safe. I was lucky. All whom the thieving magpie robbed delights in the private joke. Strandloper is much a novel made by a community as an individual. The original reason for my turning out my files at that summer solstice was that I was too exhausted to do anything else. I had spent 6 weeks traveling 46,000 miles to lecture in Canada, the United States, and Australia. The Australian visit had been arranged by my closest friend, who has given me the sobriquet of Monkey Academic instead of Academic Monk. He is professor, now emeritus professor, Ralph Elliott, a descendant of Martin Luther, nephew of Nobel laureate Max Born, and cousin to Ben Elton and to Olivia Newton-John, and then Master of University House at the Australian National University in Canberra. His speciality is runic inscriptions, in which he is the acknowledged ultimate authority, and an internationally respected scholar of Old and Middle English, especially of Chaucer and the Gawain poet and of the works of Thomas Hardy. We met because he wrote to tell me that I must be the first writer since the 14th century to use the same dialect and landscape in my writing as the Gawain poet had used in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And we had, from different backgrounds and disciplines, arrived at the same answer in identifying the location of the Green Chapel. We are also concerned in the nature of the matter of Britain and the need for it to be kept alive by its working and reworking. For me, Strandloper is Gawain and the Green Knight. The elements of the matter of Britain are in both. It was vital that I had seen Australia, seen its lights and hues, smelt its smells, heard its sounds. Without them, it would have been an insult to dare the quest. The other ingredient, without which it would not have started, was the tireless generosity of Ralph Elliott and his position that gave him access to the libraries and archives of Australia. He had the means to dig out and photocopy rare books, unique books, diaries, notes, sketches and letters, all the paraphernalia of the land that was to become William Buckley's. Ralph himself is a William Buckley. He left Germany as a teenager, one step ahead of the SS, to come to Britain knowing three words of English. His mother told him it was necessary to know only two in order to get by in that benighted land: corned beef and darling. His cousin said that with one more word he would be entirely at ease among the British. All he had to say frequently was bugger. Thus armed, Ralph set out from the chapel at midnight, pricking over the plain, to develop a career devoted to the enlightenment of the English language around the world. So for Australian documentary research, I had my mole. His most outrageous feat was to send me a photocopy of the only book to describe in detail the physical culture of the Aborigines, of the area where William Buckley spent his 32 years. 978 pages by express airmail letter post. In such ways, I was kept secure and happy in the research. I had all the external facts I needed. The historical William Buckley was shipped out both as a convict and as a bricklayer, a mechanic, to build a new penal colony in what was decreed by the British government to be terra nullius, no one's land. One piece of William's workmanship survives, as fragments of a concrete armoury he built, which are now the crazy paving of a garden path in Ramsey Street. But William had brooded on other ideas. He had long decided to walk back home. Possibility of this was a common belief among the convicts. Head north along the coast, reach China, turn left, and there you are. They even drew compasses on scraps of paper to keep them from going off course. The land was so hostile and fear of the Indians so great that little attempt was made to recapture an escapee. Either he would come back begging to be let into camp, or he would never be seen again. Once William Buckley was out of range of the sentries, he was presumed dead. After 3 months, the penal colony failed for lack of water, departed and founded Hobart. The land was left to itself. Meanwhile, William followed the coast to China. Unfortunately, he was inside the narrow mouth of Port Phillip, the caldera of an extinct volcano. He did not know how to get food or water, and his progress was slow, his physical condition not good and worsening. After some 95 miles of walking in terrible conditions, he completed the circuit of Port Phillip and found himself looking across the entrance, straight at the ship and into the camp. Among the photocopies that Ralph sent me was a critical edition of the ghosted first-person account of William's life in the bush, which was recorded by a hack journalist from Hobart after William's return to the whites. From this, I was able to relate the Aboriginal names of physical features to their modern equivalents and could plot William's long journey. Instead of giving up when he saw the penal colony had staggered 95 miles to escape, he turned away and continued to head northeast for China. But he was travelling southwest. This he continued to do for about 200 miles. Then the text showed that he stopped, turned around and set off, moving away from the sea but in the right direction. Why had he been 180 degrees out? And how had he come to discover his error? It is in the apparent anomalies that the most significant and exciting aspects of research are to be found. When I saw it, I felt time and space dissolve. I was with William Buckley, I was William Buckley, as I watched him work out his error. He had not realized that in the southern hemisphere, in that mad land that seemed to have been decided to kill, where even the rivers were salt, the sun at noon was not in the south, but in the north. He made for China. It had always been impossible. At last his body, after another 200 miles, and what must have been more than a year of solitude, stumbling, dehydrated and starved, gave out. But his mind did not. He could not walk, so he crawled. He crawled until he came to a low hillock, and with fading vision he saw a stick planted at the top of the hillock, a stick to help him to walk to China. He crawled for the stick, took hold of it, and with that last effort he collapsed and should have died. He was found by a group of Aborigines. They had no knowledge of white men, but it was an Aboriginal belief that the dead became white. And here was this white giant, lying not on the hillock, but on the grave mound of a hero, warrior, wise man, healer and lawgiver, Murangurk. And he was holding not a stick, but Murangurk's spear. Murangurk had come back to his people. It was as if Arthur had returned from Avalon. For 32 years, William Buckley was Murangurk. And here the anomalies began to pile up. It would be understandable that having made the journey from Tharangalakalkabek, the skyland, the country country, he would be in shock and have forgotten his language and customs, but he would remember given time. William had to have more going for him to be able to remain Murangurk for 30 years. Also, I could infer something about Murangurk. Among Australian Aborigines, there is an unbreakable rule that when somebody dies, the name must be never spoken again. There is one exception. If the individual has been of the highest spiritual rank, that of shaman, the name may be spoken. So Murangurk had been a shaman. Tough on William. Yet 32 later, the opportunistic British, who within a few years exterminated the irritating niggers, often for sport, was saved by the authority of a Murangurk who was very much respected and wholly in control. What started out as a 20-year-old bricklayer was now a leader of thinkers and warriors. That, for me, the novelist, was the crux, the conscious reason for writing the book. How was a priest, philosopher, healer, leader of great intelligence to communicate his wisdom in a language that no European spoke? How could his only point of contact, the Cheshire dialect and the convict cant of an immature man, be used to tell what he knew? It was historically impossible. That's why the name of William Buckley has no place in Australia's list of folk heroes. Apart from his usefulness as an interpreter's being abused and his laying of the first brick in what was to become Melbourne, he was discarded as a fellow of low intellect and brutish nature who had fallen instantly to the level of the heathen, to the extent that he had not even tried to introduce to them the word of God. That perhaps William had no need, that perhaps he had been initially the acolyte, would never have been countenanced. And here I nearly foundered. Ralph was in England and we were talking. I said that I reached a point beyond which I could not go. For the first time, despite 6 years' work, I should have to have bought a book. The impregnable barrier was the Aboriginal mind. I had no wish to invade their philosophy, which is largely sacred secret, and it is their last privacy and dignity. But unless I knew something of its truth, my Aboriginal characters and the change from William Buckley to Murrungurk could not be shown as they naturally would have behaved, as a result of reflecting, not revealing, the teachings of the esoteric culture. And there was no way in. Ralph went home the next day. Shortly after, I had a letter from one of Australia's anthropologists, the leading one for my purpose, because not only is she an anthropologist, but is a full member of an Aboriginal kinship group, is a female elder, and of such high rank, she has the authority to adjudicate over both men and women's matters. In a letter, she said that Ralph had told her that I was stuck, and she wanted to know whether she could help. She had a long-standing invitation to lecture in Lisbon, and the fee would pay her airfare to Manchester. And so I engaged with the Aboriginal mind among the throng and coloured neon of Manchester Airport. We recognised each other on sight, spontaneously broke into laughter, and before we were clear of the car park ramps, she had begun. I continued to say she because of her wish to remain anonymous. Her work involves negotiating, finagling, and manoeuvring for the pure Aborigines, and she prefers to keep a low profile. To me, she is lovingly known as the Southern Sybil. Education in Aboriginal teaching is inferential, not, as with us, instructional. A pupil is shown something, or told a story, or given a statement in metaphorical images, rather than through grammatical and syntactical logic. And depending on the reaction, it is either moved forward or automatically returns to the start. It is akin to a fail-safe flowchart system of religious and philosophical wisdom. It's also a protection for the individual. We do not let people drive Formula One cars on the day they collect their driving license. As a result, Southern Sybil presents herself in such a way that the impatient, intolerant, inflexible, and therefore unsuitable mind is irritated by what appears to be a deliberately elliptical, verbally dexterous and batty old woman. That is a serious and often terminal mistake. But stay with this Delphic nuisance and things start to happen within oneself. A new grammar and syntax form, and thought takes a new shape, an Aboriginal shape. Once this is established, the Sybil uses both Hellenistic and Aboriginal models, both intellectually highly demanding, to express what has to be conveyed in the most efficient way. I knew fairly soon that I had passed a crucial test from an Aboriginal point of view, and I asked the Sybil why she had crossed the world on Ralph's say-so. It was necessary, she said. The only moment of doubt I had was we were about to touch down in Manchester, and I thought, dear God, what if he's not up to it? But when we both laughed before we spoke, I knew that we should dance well. That was 1989. We have danced well. The dance goes on and will, for it has led me to see what has always given spring to my step, why my books are eternally different, eternally the same. The Aborigine would call it my dreaming, my song and my dance. The books are a vehicle for and then marker of the journey. It is why, once my duty towards them has been discharged, I have no further interest in them per se. It is not to claim that I disparage them. They are swept up and still exist in the cumulative intricacy and simplicity of the dance. Already Strandloper is taking its place, giving way to the new song that is made possible by my writing of that portion of spiritual autobiography with the help of so many people, foremost among them who are Ralph Elliott, Southern Sybil, William Buckley, and particularly my wife and our children, who've had to live the soaking and the waiting. The magpie must also be given his due. He is not quite the random thief that I may have made him. It's not by chance he occurs as a principle in Aboriginal creation myths. Without him, the book would not be as it is, nor would I be as spiritually enlarged as I feel myself to be. I woke one morning with that imperative voice in my head. I had learned the voice is also known to the Aboriginal mind, and it is held as a source of inspiration. It is called the voice that thunders. It said, go to Martin Church. Go now. Martin Church is not only the oldest timber-frame church in Europe, it is the focal point of Strandloper. I went, and as I entered the church I had known all my life and considered to be one of the holy places of the world. I saw it through Aboriginal eyes for the first time, and was as a human being dumbfounded, and as a writer aware that all the cards had finally been dealt. An Aboriginal elder, knowing nothing of architecture or of Christianity, would recognise Martin as sacred, for the magpie had discovered entopic lines. Entopic lines were first published by two South African anthropologists, J.D. Lewis Wilson and T.A. Dowson, in Current Anthropology in 1988. They had noticed the same abstract patterns tended to appear in all preliterate art and iconography, in all places and at all times, from the Upper Paleolithic cave paintings of France and Spain to the modern religious art of the Kalahari Bushmen. There are about six patterns, and they are invariable: zigzag, cross-hatching, honeycomb, carinate, dot and circle stroke spiral. Lewis Wilson and Dowson consulted neurologists who reported the same patterns that are found in three conditions of the human brain. They appear to be projected as external images by people entering grand mal epileptic seizures, by many migraineurs, and as a result of shamans entering trance or ecstatic states. The ritual body painting of Aboriginal adepts and the abstractions of the stained glass windows of medieval Martin are the same. Both William Buckley and Moranga could have known them. What I had been expecting, a green man of foliate head disguised, our daughter found later. No composer of Strandloper could have wished for more. The entopic lines created the jacket of the book and they made the climax of the story. At the start, I dodged the question of why I have written by saying I have had no choice. But why no choice? Only with Strandloper have the last 40 years become wholly clear. I am a member of a family of rural craftsmen, but I use my hands in a different way. I have spent those 40 years in trying to celebrate the land and tongue of a culture that has been marginalised by metropolitan intellectualism, that churns out canonical prose through writers who seem unable to allow new concepts or to integrate the diversity of our language, who draw on the library, ignorant of the land, on the head bereft of the heart, making of fair speech mere rustic conversation, so that I am led to ask, have we become so lazy that we have lost the will to read our own language except at its most anodyne? And from that reading, too lazy to create. For true reading is creativity, the willingness to look into the open hand of the writer to see what may or may not be there. A writer's job is to offer. There were two spurs to my endeavour. The first was the realisation that a well-meaning teacher had washed out my mouth with carbolic soap when I was 5 years old for what she called talking broad. What she did not know was the language of one of the treasures of English poetry. The second was the earliest surviving example, which may have been the sum of his literacy, of writing by a Garner. The signature of another William is a slashed, fierce cross made with the anger of a pen held in the fist as a dagger. "There is only the fight to recover what has been lost," T.S. Eliot says in East Coker. "The rest is not our business." So it was gratifying when a professor of humanities at St. Louis University wrote, "There is in Strandloper a kind of thesis, how a precious mythology was allowed to slip by controlling political literary agenda. Most of all, there is a refusal to grieve. The people are dead, but the words lie like stones, indestructible as the land and as invincible." to have been able to use my indoctrination into academy as a means to free a suppressed concrete voice, to give a slashed cross a flowing hand, open to offer our starved and arid prose, if but one way out of the library, back to its enriching soil, has been a privilege and an apprenticeship. That apprenticeship, the quest from gash and slash of a cross, by way of carbolic soap, to the voice that thunders, is over. Now I can begin. Indeed, I already have. I'm concluding this talk really with the just a couple of quotes from the final chapter of Strandloper. The story that we find in The Voice That Thunders and that unfolds through listening to The Voice That Thunders, that is buried deeply in all of us, is shown here in the return of William Buckley to his own land, having spent 32 years in Australia as Murungak, the shaman. So we have him here walking back to his own village. He followed the turnpike through Sitherton, past Reedsmere and over Monk's Heath by Radnor Woods, and took the path up the long ridge back by White Barn to the top, where it flattened out at Mount Ship and Castle Rock. He sat on the brim of the rock and looked down the 400 feet to the fields and the voices and the house below. He was thirsty. A lizard crawled from underneath the stone to bask, and he grabbed it, knocked its head, and opened its skin with his teeth. The meat was sweet, and the juices cooled him. He walked along the ridge until he could climb down among the trees and into Holy Well Slack by Glaze Hill to the house. He sat at the hedge cop of the garden and waited for the waters to rise. There was a low room at the end of the house, and in it he heard a rattle and a sound like clapsticks. But it was no dance that he knew. Esther came out of the back door of the house and went into the garden to a stone slab. He watched her, but he did not speak. She was wearing a straw hat with a wide brim, and from it hung a black veil. She had on a dark dress with a high neck and a veil, and the veil tucked into the neck. The wrists and bodice were tight. She had on a white pinafore, and strung drawers were tucked into her boots. Her hands were gloved, and she carried a pail of water. She saw him. "Oh, can you wash a soldier's shirt?" sang William. "And can you wash it clean?" she answered. "Oh, can you wash a soldier's shirt? And hang it on the green. Now then, Will. Now then, Het. That's a rum way of sitting. You'll do yourself a mischief, I shouldn't wonder. Where have you been this journey?" "Oh, up atop of Down Yonder, miles endy way the nose, at Bog of Miralees, where cats kittle magpies." She laughed. "And where are you at?" he said. "Just taking a skep of honey. You're never going to drown them bees." "Yea, but I am. How else?" "You munna kill them. They've gotten spirit, same as thee." He stood up and went to her. The dog lay on the cop. "Hold still," William said to Esther, and he started to dance the bee. Esther dropped the pail and ran to the door. "He danced the Rungarong." "Will?" "He danced." "Is that what they learn you?" "He danced and stopped." He lifted the skep from the stone and turned it. Esther slammed the door shut and opened it a crap. "Will, you're daft, they'll have you." William began to sing, and the bees left the skep and settled on him, over him, his clothes and face and skin, until no part of him could be seen but the burrs of the hair and the wings, and he sang. And when the skep was empty, he took out a comb of honey. He looked at it. The comb was a dreaming, but flat at the tip where it had been fixed to the skep. There was no silence for a greater dream. Yet the net of the comb was the 6 points of time, the joining of the song. He took out all the combs and laid them on the slab. The bees left him and flew back to the skep. He put it down and picked up the combs. Esther opened the door. "Well, they do learn you summat," she said. "Aye, they do," said William. "Come thee ways with an air of the fire and get some warmship." She led him into the house. He had to stoop beneath the beams. "Sit thee down, take thee backer, stick thee nose out the chimney." Put the combs and the slop stone she had covered with white linen, and sat on the floor by the hearth. "You're looking well." "Aye." "Shall you have a wet of tea?" "No." "Some buttermilk?" "No." "What then? Yon's a nasty cough." "Aye, it seems I can't shift it since I came home." "Then it's honey and allager for you, my lad," said Esther, and she poured honey from a jar into a pan, added vinegar, warmed it on the fire, stirring the mixture, tipped it into a mug and gave it to William. "Get that down there," she said. "Aye," William laughed, "that's about it. Honey and allager, that reckons it up, it does, the whole beggaring cheese." But he drank. He went to the dresser. The shelves were laden with blue and white plates, the edges gilded except for the one in the middle, the small one he had seen before. He picked it up and looked at it closely. "China. Hey, dear, well, well." He put it down. "And all this effort, have you grown a flavour for them or what?" "It was Yedart at wedding." "Yedart, aye, he would, and gold and all. I always did say you were a chap very fluent in giving." William lifted the veil net and rolled it off her face. "I'm back, Het. Aye, same as I said. You did. What's that racking? Racket." The clapping sound could be heard from the other end of the house. "William," said Esther, "he's at weaving silk, a little master. He works two markets, Stockport and Macclesfield. He weaves all hours. Is he mine?" "He favours Yedart, but you called him Will." "I did." "Aye. Leave him be now." "Yea." He sat down again. "What must we do, Het?"
"Do?"
"I'm back. Same as I said. I said I'd come. I told you. But you've not waited."
"Wait? 30-odd years? You were transported youth."
"But I said..." "Yea, and what was I to do? And Joseph's a good un. He took me and William, and never a word against him." "No pobs without salt, no burying without laughing, Will."
"There's more nor pobs. It's all in your head, Will."
Sat for a long time, staring at the fire, silent. "But I told you, did you not hear?"
"I heard."
He stared again for a longer time. "What must I do, Het? I don't know what to do."
"Well, you can't just sit there gondering.
Shape yourself. You could go for a bricksetter." "8 months in chains I lay for thee."
"No."
"My own water I supped for thee. Give over."
"Eggy moe I cut for thee." She gripped his wrist.
"And eggy moe I drank for thee."
He was lost again in the fire.
"The clashing rock I dared for thee."
"Eh?"
"The hard dark I walked for thee. Bone of the cloud I rode for thee."
"Well, you make no sense.
And could you not bide and wait for me? But I never asked you, I never, it was you."
Silence again, then he stood and looked down at her.
"Was it for nought, nought then and nought now, all nought?"
"Not nought."
"Nought, me, nought, back here for this, nought, nought, beggar bungel." He slumped over the table. And Esther saw there was no strength left to him, and that he was crying. "Back up, love," she said. "As long lives a merry man as a sorry. But where's me dreaming? Who's dreaming?"
"You best have this," he said, and he reached into his bag, and he took out the lifeless Wallung and put it on the table. "I'm done, it's finished."
"The swaddle did aff, you kept it.
Take it, you found it, it's yours. That canna hurt a broken glass."
"No, Will. A swaddle did aff, from me to thee."
She pushed it towards him, moved it into the sun. It caught the light, filled the room with colour.
"Pussy washing dishes," said Esther to the patterns moving on the walls. He watched and felt a warmth and a memory returning and life in his face.
"Thundal.
Het.
Wallung. het. He lifted the crystal. Puran Murnin, Talawarnin, Thundal, O het. She smiled, you daft Hapeth. He put the Thundal in his medicine bag. He unrolled the veil and covered her face and tucked the veil around her neck. I must be doing. She went with him to the door. Be good, Will Buckley, said Esther. Be good, and then. He strode away across the garden, the clap of the loom he now knew, and he danced for the man inside, whoever he was. The dog whined, but stayed on the cop and did not follow. Be good, Jip. He climbed Glear's Hill and shouted to the sky. Kimmery Kimo, Kimmery Kimo, Kimmery Kiltikari, Kimmery Kimo. String strang pamadili, lama pamratag, ring dong bomanini kimo. Before he left, he walked Esther's dreaming. He walked the holy well by saddle bowl and term and stormy point, to golden stone and seven firs and thieves hole. He walked the beacon. Then down from the ridge, he walked for Buckley. He walked Fern Hill and Sodger's Hump. At Worcesterfield, he passed his Uncle Jim's and looked in through the window of the room where he was born. He walked Windy Harbour, Withington, Weltroff, over the Tunstead and down to Gleeds Moss and Trap Street, Clunterbrook, and up to Mutlow. He walked and sat beneath the trees on Mutlow. He heard the songs of Neongara in the wind among the stones and the hills around. A quietness settled on him, and in the quietness the Hamistan sing. He rose and went. He felt a rhythm that began to fill him as he listened. William Buckley left the hamestand to the rock, to the oak. He entered in. He reached for the jackstones down the hollow. He took out the shiny pebbles, and now he saw they were not jackstones, but blades of flint. The people had made him Yambich and Warrowill. The people had known the oak. One tree was all, and all the world one dreaming. He looked up, kush, 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 kush. He put the flints in the medicine bag and dug with his hands in the leaf moulds until he came to the charcoal of the fire. He took the charcoal and rubbed it into his face. Then he tore two branches from the living wood, and Shikshak went down from the oak and into the bowl that had been the mere. He kicked off his shoes and felt the land. He stood holding the branches upright. The mere was waiting. Under the ground he felt the water run. For fear you make the golden bird to weep. He put a green branch around each shoulder, his black face, and went to the church and in by the belfry. The framing of the tower enclosed him as the oak, and split light dappled swaddly daff through the glass, and one small piece of red round glass was Neongara rising on his wings of flame. Shikshak entered the nave and smelt the forest of the church. Before him the east window was filled with churiningas and dreamings, and the coiling length of Binbial and the interweaving circles of the three points of time. In the biggest churinga was a man in red and white, speaking Wurundjeri Baluk with his fingers and saying all. He stood at the grey, dry stone font and gripped the rim of two of the sides. Across were the south door and the window of the man in the oak and the crown of glory. He looked into the blind eyes of the sleeping god and saw the face of his nephew painted in the way of his first dreaming above the solemn path of the snake, black on a white headland, its fires marked with a dot in each curve of each bend and his churinga below. Water of life, water of death, each has my soul fed. Sun, river and thunder, give me new breath. He held the crystal in the font and the mirror bubbled up the stone to the rim. He scooped his hand to drink. He lifted the branches against his pillar. He put the medicine bag on the font and took out balls of clay, white, black, yellow and red. He pulled off his clothes and slowly painted his body with the clay, using the font to work a paste. Morangirk painted his own dreamings and his people. He tied on his headband and set cowrie and plover in his hair and the feather from an eagle's wing. He put coim through his nose, and when he had finished, he went and laid the branches on the altar and turned to face the church. Mulla Mulang moved him, and he danced the crow for his neighbour, for his nephew, and for the warriors. His feet walked slowly, but he did not stop, and he heard the rug drums and the clapsticks, and the people were singing. He danced faster, and they lifted him, and the choir was filled with them. Then he danced the morning star and left the altar dancing, and the hollow logs beneath the chancel and the nave boomed as he stamped. He danced the morning star. The windows flared Holin, Koraminga, Cuckoo Bread, Torumba, Navdu, Galiscassins, Devilberry, Jackanapes, Gobori, Mokathandra, Vervi, Balara, Popal Mara, Karagata, Daragan, Robin ran in the hedge, and the east sent a rainbow to the mere of the font. He danced in the rainbow and about the trees, in the drums and the song, and he danced at the font for the man in the oak and the crown of glory, but the eyes were blind. He left the drumming and the song, and he danced into silence. The paint and the bright sweat melted to air. Through the silence came the voice of Tundun, and he danced beyond Mulla Mulung. He danced the evening star. His step was with the voice of Tundun. He danced the evening star to bring the warriors home, and made the path of Morangurak's five ways. He danced the evening star for the blind eyes in the crown, and the eyes of the glass opened, and Nulla Boyen looked at him. For the church was light, and the scent of oak and the scent of bull. From the south door lay the bush of Biangala to the sea. Tundun and the silence and the song were all and one. Strandlopa entered into his bone country. The wave bore his right foot and the earth his left. He walked with Bin Bial, son of Bunjil. There came an eagle. Here is the start of the dream, and how the sweet sorrow is sung. And this is the end of the book called Strandlopa. It speaks to us now as it has always spoken. Written in time, it is written in eternity. And as we listen to its sounds, and we listen to the words of Alan Garner, we might remember something he was once told by the Southern Sibyl. She says this: the great serpent has woken, Jarapiri stirs, the earth shakes, and the warriors are gathering. And Garner responds to her phrase by this, saying this: that's about the top and the bottom of it, the whole beggaring cheese. I've given you a story, not too long and not too short. Just the same length, same as from you to me. And I'll tell you more gladly, but that's as much as I know. And that truly is as much as I know. Thank you for listening.